You're listening to a Yes Music Podcast interview special. So I'm delighted that Mike Murphy has been able to join me this afternoon for the first ever Yes Music Podcast interview special. So let's get straight on with it then, Mike. So first of all, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your musical activities that you're involved with at the moment?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoy the podcast. I think it's one of the best podcasts out there. I've been historically listened to a lot of them, looking for them. Musical podcasts or things that had music-related themes, and I hadn't found a whole lot that was good. So it was great to stumble upon yours. I'm really enjoying it. As far as myself, I'm a guitarist and a bassist. Dabble with the piano a little bit. Full-time teacher these days. Also perform in and out of different bands, and I love to write. So I've been writing a lot of blog posts and books, published two books recently, one called Grow, Teach, Repeat, which is for mostly guitar instructors, and then a second book called Choosing Notes, which is more geared toward musicians of all kinds. It's kind of a music theory book, but not a traditional one, not real heavy on the principles of music, more of a creative approach to music theory for people who know a little bit about music theory already and want kind of a fresh approach to it. So those are the two books that I have out right now and as ebooks, available on barnesandnoble.com and amazon.com. So writing is my thing right now. But as far as my history, it's not a grand one. It's, your average guitar player in St. Louis, Missouri, trying to make a living teaching and playing. And now writing.
Great, and you've got a couple of really good blogs. Just tell us where we can find those.
Twilightguitar.wordpress.com. That's my blog. I've been writing a lot of posts. They have a philosophical bent to them lately. Some of them are technical music posts, but a lot of them are more off into more of creative ideas surrounding music and the idea of learning music. There's so much out there these days on this scale or that scale, this chord or that chord. So I try and take a little bit deeper approach to music. And it's working for me. I really enjoy it. I've had a lot of good feedback on it, and I'm sure I'm going to keep it going. So it's been a lot of fun.
That's great, and I enjoyed your recent post on riffs, which helped me out with something I was trying to explain in the Yes Music podcast as well, so that was really good.
Yeah, I heard that. That was great. Like I said earlier, offline, to hear your name being mentioned on a podcast is great, and especially on one as fine as yours is. It's a...
That's very kind. So, this is the Yes Music podcast, as you know, so... Can you tell us how you got interested in the music of the world's greatest progressive rock band?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was roundabout on my 1970s RCA FM radio, which I still have and love. It's one of those tabletop units that the family had, and I was, before I had a proper stereo system that came on the air, it just floored me completely. And to this day, I can listen to it and have the same feelings. Great song. But that was the first song. And then from there, I met someone in high school who was a big Yes fan, who just pushed me on and introduced me to the rest of their albums at that time. And just really loved everything they were doing. So, yeah, Roundabout was the thing for me. That song just did it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? That it seems to be that Yes is one of those bands that you do get introduced to, or at least you know, are taken on in your love of the band by a friend. The same thing happened to me. One of my best friends at school lent me both Tormato and 90125, which is when I got into it. It was around 90125, and I played those tapes out. You know, I completely wore them out by playing them, and in fact I never gave them back to the guy who lent me them. Got so obsessed with the music myself.
I think he knows where to find you now.
Yeah, quite possibly. So with your expertise in everything guitar related, I'd be fascinated in your thoughts on Yes guitarists. So we've got limited time, so we'll talk mainly about the big two Yes guitarists, Steve Howe and Trevor Rabin. Very different players, as I'm sure you'd agree. But what about the original Yes guitarist, Peter Banks? I know that Yes fans are sometimes very fiercely divided about Peter Banks. And do you rate his playing highly, you know, on Yes and Time of the Word?
Oh, very highly. I think that, well, first of all, to be in a band the caliber of Yes, you're not going to be a slouch on the guitar. He was an amazing guitar player, and I think his work on those first two albums influenced Steve Howe greatly, although I hadn't heard too much of Howe's work before those two albums. It was clear that he had to learn that material to perform it with the band, and I think it was there was a real continuity there between what they were both doing. Steve Howe brought a lot more, I'd say, pure classical influence to what was going on. But Peter Banks, the jazz lines that he would play, the way that he blended in with the keyboards on the records, he was a lot like Steve Hackett with Genesis, I think, in that sense. There's a lot of times you couldn't really tell what the guitar was doing because the guitar and the keys just blended in so nicely. And, you know, when Steve Howe came along, I think he you could tell when Steve Howe was playing the guitar, and he just put it out there a little more upfront, a little more in your face, which I think was great, a great place to take Yes at that time, that point in time in the 70s. So, you know, I think he was great, and you don't get to be in a band with John Anderson and Chris Squire and the others unless you're good, and Peter Banks was very good. I don't even know what you mean when you talk about the Yes community being divided about Peter Banks and Steve Howe. What could you explain that a little bit? I kind of missed that discussion, I think, over the years.
Well, there's a great deal of animosity, and I've not read all the books, but Peter Banks himself has a great deal of animosity, you know, with the rest of the band. He feels he was very, very badly treated by the band, I think. You'd have to talk to the Yes historians to get the full picture on that. But I think it's led some Yes fans, perhaps slightly unfairly, to rate Banks quite, you know, as not like as good a player as Steve Howe. And don't get me wrong, I think Steve Howe is a fantastic player, but I think Banks has got a lot going for him as well. As I think, and again, I'm not a great historian of this, but as I think he's proved with his later career.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guitar player. There's the rest of that, you know, the critics and the people that look at the politics of it all. I don't even want to go there because it just doesn't matter to me. I've been in bands, you know, so I understand how that works. And it really is separate from anything that's done musically, I think, especially when it comes to being a listener. You know, we're just judging it, or at least I am, just judging on what I hear. And there's always going to be squabbles. But yeah, as far as musically goes, he was a great guitar player. And as is Steve Howe and Trevor Rabin, you know, there's no problem with the first two albums are, you know, Yes wouldn't be what they are without that evolution. So it had to be that way. And I just think they're great albums. The first two albums I absolutely love. I didn't discover them late till later. Of course, my first one was Fragile. So I had to go back into it and listen to those and love them.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, let's move on to talk a bit more about Steve Howe then. And you've already said that there are some classical elements that come in there, and I think I've heard some folk, and but I'm really not an expert. But what I think I can see is that even within the same piece, he often uses many different styles and techniques. Are there any that you think are particularly key to his style?
Well, sure. I mean, his jazz soloing technique is all over the place, pretty much on every song. His classical, influence is obvious on the solo piece "Mood for a Day," and another one of my favorites is on the "Tales of Topographic Oceans" in "The Ancient Giants Under the Sun." Near the end, he goes off into a classical bit with John Anderson's singing over it, and I think that adds so much to what Yes was doing in those days. As a matter of fact, that's his "Mood for a Day." It was inspired me to pick up classical guitar and study it seriously for a long time. But yeah, he can play jazz. He'll bust out into a Chuck Berry lick from time to time. Yeah, and then he'll be doing the classical stuff and the Chet Atkins style, like on the clap and other places. They're peppered throughout the songs. I couldn't even come up with a specific song in it if I I could if I needed to, but it's everywhere, and he works those things in so smoothly from one style to the next within the same song that it's remarkable. He is a true talent.
And I wonder if it's to do with the fact that he's clearly a master of all those different styles, which enables him to move between instruments and move between moods and move between different techniques in the same song. Because of course, when Yes get into their orchestral style pieces, their classical influences there, then he's perhaps one of the very few guitarists in the world who could have filled that role alongside someone like Rick Wakeman, again with all his different influences.
Oh, definitely. You know, it's the depth of his abilities, right? His skills, but it's more than that, because he has the sense of dynamics and in his playing. And not just that, it's also the colors that he uses. He'll be playing pedal steel. He'll be playing steel string acoustic guitar, 12 string once in a while. He'll use the wah pedal. He'll play, straight up electric guitar with several different types of tones, distortion, clean. He really runs the gamut. He takes everything the guitar can do, and he puts it together in a way that just flows. So, like I say, even in the same song, he can pull that off.
Yeah. The two things that I'm quite interested with his style is the use of the slide guitar that's I'm assuming that's the correct terminology for it, the one that's on like the table.
Yeah, pedal steel.
Yeah, all right, that's what pedal steel. What kind of music was that used in before, and do you think Howe was the first person to bring it into prog rock, or at least rock?
Well, I'm not sure if he was the first. Couldn't tell you that, but it was used in country music mostly. David Lindley used it with the Eagles quite a bit in the 70s. He was a master at it himself. But yeah, Steve Howe on the Close to the Edge and on Going for the One albums, he uses it extensively on there as well. And it's some of my favorite moments. It really creates an atmosphere with that. And again, that's just another one of his tricks. He can throw that in and jump from one to the other. I haven't seen him live in person. I've seen a lot of concerts, filmed concerts, and the way he moves about the stage, just picking up this and that instrument, is kind of impressive.
Absolutely. Is he using it in a completely different way to it's used in country music, for example?
Oh, yes. Well, technically, no. But as far as the sound he's creating and the mood he's creating, it's way different. But technically, he's playing notes from the current chord, picking out chord tones and scales that fit, improvising lines that work over what's going on. So musically, he's doing it different in terms of mood and color and creating a Yes song, But musically, he's following the rules and of harmony and really extending that instrument so that it creates something that keyboards just can't do. I love keyboards, but it has the same kind of eerie effect at times, but with a much more fluid kind of style that wasn't really available to keyboards until the synthesizers came out, and the Moog synthesizers with the flywheel, what do they call that? The pitch shifting wheel. They could kind of approach that sound, but on the pedal steel, in Steve Howe's hands anyway, on the pedal steel guitar, it's something that other instruments just can't approach as far as the mood it creates.
That's great, thank you. The other aspect of his style that I've noticed when I've been listening to these main sequence albums particularly is the use of those runs, and I presume they're scales or whatever that he picks out. And I wondered if you were able to tell, do you think they are those runs that he goes on as a kind of accompaniment, where I'd expect to see in my layman's terms, a guitarist playing some chords or a solo or whatever. He seems to go on these elaborate runs, and I was just wondering if you thought they were improvised at the time of recording or whether they were very carefully worked out beforehand.
Oh, I'm sure it's a little of both. Somebody at his ability, at his level of playing, they know the chords in the song, and they know in general what they want to do, and they know what the other players are doing, and that he will work out a lot of it. But I would, that probably 20-30% of what he's doing in each song is improvised based around a central idea. He knows what he's doing going in. If you heard one recording of a song that they did in the studio, and let's say they released another version of it, the guitar playing would be similar, but there would be a lot of places where he was playing something completely different. A fill here, a fill there would be completely different from song to song. But the general, the main part would all be pretty much there, I'm sure. But because he's so influenced by jazz, and because he's so knowledgeable about the chords and the harmony, I think it would be the same for the keyboard work as well. Every time they record that song, or every take that they do, is going to be a little bit different, and a lot of times completely different notes, but they're all going to work,
Yeah, and that's interesting because of the recently unreleased studio practice takes and so on that we get on the CDs these days. And maybe there's a chance for me, once I've finished the albums themselves, to come back to those extra tracks and see what the differences are. It'd be very interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, once they get it down in the recording studio, right, and they say, okay, this is our take. This is the one, they might have five or six different takes of this track or that track, and different versions of each individual's part. They assemble that, that becomes the record, right? Well, at that point, and this is what I really like about Yes, another band, Genesis as well, and Rush, three of my favorite bands, they all do this, which I really like. Once they record that version, even if there's a long extended solo in that where you might very well improvise, when they play it live, a lot of the time, they will do the recorded version of that solo note for note. So that becomes, once they decide on the recorded version, that those improvised bits become written in stone, more or less. They perform them that way over and over. So they become compositions where at first they were improvisations. And I really appreciate when bands do that, because you go to the show or you see a live concert on video, and there's a certain magic that happens when you hear that same solo. You hear that, hit those notes you're expecting. A lot of bands don't do that. A lot of bands, you'll go here. Sometimes you can't even tell it's the same song because they're improvising parts that they just improvised in the studio. And that's cool too. But I really appreciate when bands take the time to basically learn their own songs after they've recorded them. And like I said, there's magic there. There's magic because everybody in that room or that hall has heard those records. And when they nail those solos like they are on those records, there's that, I think it really creates an exciting show. Rush does that. They're famous for that. Genesis also. But Yes, because they've had so many musicians come in and out of that band, that's been kind of hard to do.
Well, I think that brings us very neatly onto Steve Howe's successor in the band, Trevor Rabin, or Rabin, or however you pronounce it. And very, very different guitarist. And when I listen to 90125, it's his style seems to be very much more of the 80s arena rock, but still with hugely intricate parts. And what sounds to me like, again, it's just the sheer number of notes that the guy uses in some of the solos and so on. What can you tell us about his style that's different from Steve Howe's?
Well, yeah, obviously, you know, Steve Howe was influenced by the 50s and 60s guys. You know, I mentioned Chuck Berry and Chet Atkins and people like that, and even Joe Pass and Andre Segovia, people who were doing things in the 50s and 60s. Trevor, you know, he comes along. He's been influenced. I don't know how old he is, but I'm guessing he was more influenced by what was happening in the 60s and 70s. You know, the Cream and the Led Zeppelin, bands like that. And you can hear, you know, Eddie Van Halen, even. You can hear that in his playing. He'll hit those big distorted power chords where Steve Howe is a little bit more clean more of the time. But yeah, he is more of you hit it perfectly. He's an 80s. He's an 80s guy, and his sound, the production of those records, 90125, was so different, incredibly different from the production on the other Yes records. Not just the songwriting, but the, you know, the production of that. And that hit just at the right time when that came out. They had such an incredible sound. It turned a lot of people on to Yes that hadn't been turned on to them before. It was huge. I mean, coming on the radio in my car, the first time I heard that, Owner of a Lonely Heart, I guess, was in the car. We were going to a concert. I forget who we were going to see one night, but we had the radio on really loud, you know, and we're riding along, and on comes this song. I'm like, what the heck is that? And that power chords is for the opening, and it just jumped out of the radio, and then John Anderson starts singing, and I thought, oh my gosh, what is this? So I was really excited to hear that after Yes had been kind of gone for a while. And then when I looked into what was going on and discovered, you know, Trevor Rabin had produced most of that, it, you know, it made sense. But what a comeback.
Yeah, and it always amazes me when I go in and see in record shops now CDs, compilation CDs of the 80s, and I see Yes in there with Owner of a Lonely Heart. I mean, who could have predicted it that Yes became the sound of the 80s after everything they'd done in the 70s?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? They took that whole sound that was going on with the Police, right? And other bands, you know, Flock of Seagulls, you know, trying to think the Cars even. They took all that stuff and they took the Yes approach to it. And they had this sound that was just amazing. You know, Trevor's guitar, you could hear the Yes in, or the, I'm sorry, the Police, Andy Summers influence in his music. At the same time, you heard, you know, Jimmy Page, you know, and you heard Eric Clapton in there, a little bluesy stuff going on. You know, that was what was great about that record. And, you know, don't get me started on the vocals on that record. That was a piece of work. They really had a masterpiece there. But, you know, You know, some might call it overproduced, right? I've heard that said. But, you know, I think if that's overproduced, I think they'll take an overproduced album any day as far as the sales go, you know?
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to see that Trevor has gone on to become a movie composer. You know, he, and what always interested me, because my background way back was in classical music, was in, I'm a violinist. And he arranged a string quartet at the start of Love Will Find a Way, I think it was. And I was fascinated to see that. And then to see that he went on to, you know, producing full orchestrations for movies was fascinating. And it kind of fitted into the whole Yes aesthetic of the orchestrations and the pseudo symphonic type prog rock.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that he was classically trained. I don't know a whole lot about him other than what I've read really on Wikipedia. Being classically trained, you know, in his younger years, it's interesting that he joins a band like Yes, which was, I guess, originally supposed to be called Cinema. He joins a band, and really, when you think about it, the classical influence is more hidden on those records than it is with the Yes you know, other records by Yes. So it's kind of interesting that he kind of took that in a more of a rock and roll direction than a prog rock or art rock direction. With his classical training, you would think that there might be a little more of that on those records, but
yeah. Well, it's pleased me that he did the arrangement for that, because as I've said in the podcast, I have this strange and probably fairly naive idea that the purest rock is the rock that's made by the members of the band, you know, and there's no heavy production apart from by the members themselves. There's no guy coming in to do the orchestrations and add all those different parts, and that's really what I loved about those classic Yes albums, is that they were the products pretty much of those four or five guys, without anyone who was coming in, you know, a bit from outside.
Oh, I agree. Totally. Yeah. As a matter of fact, if I had to judge this stuff, you know, my favorite is going to be, you know, obviously Fragile, Close to the Edge, the Yes album. And, you know, even, you know, Tormato and Wondrous Stories, Going for the One. There's that core, I guess you'd call it. Everybody has their favorites. That's the core for me. And for exactly the reason you say, you could tell that there wasn't a whole lot of production. There didn't need to be, you know, a lot of studio tricks. There was the music, and it stood up by itself and just said, you know, listen to this. Here's what we can play. Here's what we're doing. The arrangements of the songs, you know, stood up for themselves. And yeah, you didn't need it. But like I say, when that 90125 album came out, in those days, the 80s, that's what, you know, to be considered a popular band, I suppose, or to get on the radio, let's say that, to get on the radio, you needed that sound. So, you know, you could say that Trevor did him a favor coming in with that type of production.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe they wouldn't be there today, to this day, still producing the magic that is Yes. Well, thank you very, very much for talking to us this afternoon. That's been absolutely fascinating. And I'm really pleased that you've been the first person I've managed to get hold of for these interview specials, because it's produced something which I think is very special itself and a really fascinating conversation. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Yeah, I look forward to all the future podcasts. They've really been great.